Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. This week, part one of a fine collage of commentary called The Terror Threat. Who are the real terrorists? Stay tuned and see. Unwelcome Guests is now 19 years old. It is one of the great weekly programs in alternative radio. The show was founded in the year 2000 by a really great group of anarchists. Most of the work of producing the program was done by one of them, Lynn Gurry. And work it was. Her 503 weekly installments were each 2 hours long. 2 hours of highly intelligent, provocative, spoken commentary from speeches and the occasional interview. And the show was well worth the two-hour listen, I may add. Somehow, Lynn kept it up for 10 years. She finally said, "I quit," in 2010. One of the show's admirers soon took the show over. This was Robin Upton, a brilliant English expat living in sunny Bangladesh. So, Unwelcome Guests lives on. In the past year or two, though, new installments were issued sporadically, then seemed to stop. Then, in mid-October of 2019, Robin surprised us all. A new installment of Unwelcome Guests appeared, installment number 750, titled Black is the New White. This one was not the usual 2 hours long. No, it was about 22 hours long. In it, Robin has woven together spoken passages from the show's 19 years and 1,500 hours of broadcast, organized by theme. 1,500 hours selected and snipped into pieces and rearranged and cut down to 22 hours. One's head spins. Amazingly, the result is very, very good. This week on New World Notes, and for the next couple of weeks, we will hear most of one part of Robin's magnum opus, a section titled The Terror Threat. The backbone of the section is a talk by Canadian professor and social critic John McMurtry. He spoke in Toronto in December 2001. The World Trade Center had been attacked 3 months before, and the United States had just begun a war in Afghanistan, not yet in Iraq. Instead of focusing narrowly on Afghanistan and 9/11, as he was supposed to, McMurtry decided to talk about terrorism broadly. He argues that, by any reasonable definition of terrorism, the three scariest terrorist gangs in the world are Al-Qaeda, the United States government, and the mob of capitalist bankers, financiers, and powerful corporate executives. Woven around McMurtry's brilliant talk are passages that complement and extend his points. These passages include Lynn Gurry on fracking and John Taylor Gatto on the real purposes of public schooling. We'll hear from theologian David Ray Griffin and from several other sources. Robin does not identify every voice you'll hear, but he does say the number of the Unwelcome Guests episode the passage is taken from. So you can go to their website and listen to that particular program if you like. UnwelcomeGuests.net. Here is John McMurtry.
I've been asked to speak on the topic, why is there a war in Afghanistan? and I could focus on the innumerable suspicious circumstances of this latest U.S. aerial war on a poverty-stricken country, its typical overriding of international law, its strategic fit with U.S. corporate designs for foreign oil resources, and the U.S. past strategic support of the very enemy said to be targeted, like Noriega, like Saddam, and like Milosevic in the past. But instead, I'm going to situate this latest U.S.-led war on a third world region within a much wider global process. I'm going to consider America's new war as the latest expression of a much deeper and wider terrorist campaign of an emergent totalitarian pattern of instituting world corporate rule with no limit of occupation or accountability beyond itself. Unhappily, it is not easy to see Canada's foreign policy role in all of this as anything other than obedient subjugation to this transnational corporate agenda at every senior level of decision-making. And I'm thinking of the trade negotiators at DFAT and all the way up to the minister when I say that. The unseen terrorist pattern. The gravest problem with corporate market fundamentalism is that it is decoupled from society's life conditions. Its entire model is. It is, in fact, incapable of recognizing any value to anything except corporate value adding, which it is assumed should regulate all peoples and all conditions of life on Earth for, quote, efficiency and maximum growth. To this point, there has been no outside margin, and this is the totalitarian nature of this project or program, there's been no outside margin to this total doctrine's demands or government subservience to them. Since the commitments of a society to safeguard the lives of its members and to ensure that they are able to express themselves as human is the measure of its civilization, this global corporate program is not merely uncivilized, it is beneath recognition terrorist in its meaning. For if we recognize the real meaning of terrorism, and I don't mean the meaning of terrorism that we've had with Bill C-35 and C-36, which effectively say, you know, as in I think Section 27, intended to cause serious interference with an essential facility or system, I think we see the disconnection of the very meanings of words from their actual natural meaning. Terrorism without terror. They're talking systems, not people's terror. Now, I'm going to define terrorism with some fidelity to the actual meaning of terrorism, unlike our government laws, which are part of this global program. And I would say that the real meaning of terrorism is to instill in innocent people fear for their life security, to coerce their compliance to an armed faction's demands. And I think we see this pattern increasingly at work across World Life Organization. Under the financial dictates of the corporate market, backed by rising extremes of armed force, citizens everywhere are subjected to a low-intensity campaign of destabilization and fear that leaves no aspect of their lives secure. Now, I have a lot of documentation of this, but I won't be able to get into that today. But I think this is true even in Canada, one of the world's most well-off societies, the silent terror grows. Its vast water heritage is so in peril that people unprecedentedly die from its pollution.
487.
In order to access the gas contained in shale thousands of feet below, the drillers must use a process patented by Halliburton called fracking that requires the injection of billions of gallons of a toxic brew of water, sand, and chemicals into the earth to force gas from the shale formations. This practice has already despoiled the Intermountain West and is rapidly ruining the land, water, and lives of people just to the south of me in rural Pennsylvania. The only reason they could use this toxic process was that the Bush-Cheney administration and their pals in Congress put a provision in the 2005 Energy Act exempting these drilling corporations from the Clean Air and Water Act provisions. The reason for doing so should have been obvious, but is now, sadly for those places, all too obvious. These processes poison the air and poison the water. They take clean, fresh water and ruin it. So-called development has been progressively turning Earth into a desert, through its wasteful conduct. Did you know that the Sahara Desert was once a forest? The Romans cut it down to take the wood, so all the topsoil blew away. Iraq was once a fertile crescent, not a blazing desert. Have you ever wondered why the Bible talks of cedars of Lebanon? Yes, there used to be cedars, not desert there. Greece used to have woods and springs. The history of civilization could be described as the history of humans turning earth to desert. The gas drillers are salivating at the prospect of taking all our water and fouling it for use in their profit-making activities, then dumping the polluted mess in the woods when nobody's looking, as they have already done elsewhere. What do they care? They'll trash my home the way they've trashed other people's homes. They trash places and are allowed to do so because corrupt or lazy governments allow them in the name of the sacred economy. Fact, if they had to perform their activities without ruining the land, in economic terms, without externalizing the damage for us to bear, their activities would no longer be profitable. You've heard them whining about that, right? So we and others before us are to be destroyed so they can make money. That sounds absurd, but that's pretty much the way things have been done in America. Things will go on that way until we put our feet down.
While our government sign its future away to U.S. engineered trade and investment dictates. The minds of our young are so shackled by a culture of violence and demands to buy that their capacity to think is stunted, while their public education is increasingly structured as a marketing site to reproduce students as compliant servo mechanisms.
Now, we've had quite a lot of material about schools on the show, including the audiobook from Ivan Illich, Deschooling Society. Illich referred to forced schooling as the reproductive organ of the consumer society. The following speaker, John Taylor Gatto, was a very celebrated American teacher and, to my eyes, exposed the fraud that is mass compulsion schooling like no one else. His magnum opus on the history of forced schooling, the underground history of American education, we also produced as an audiobook, and it's available for download from unwelcomeguest.net/audiobooks. I consider him to have been the greatest single whistleblower of the true purposes of mass compulsion schooling. So let's hear two sections from him, speaking about documents published in 1906. First, from episode 562.
The very first commissioner of American schooling, national commissioner of schooling, a fellow named William Torrey Harris, wrote in 1906 that the point of institutional schooling was to turn people against themselves. So he was really quite advanced. The idea of dividing and conquer usually means several parties involved, but to be divided against yourself, self-alienation is the expression he used. That was the point of it. He said, this purpose is best achieved in dark, airless corridors. In other words, in dismal places. And anyone who's passed through the usual public schooling place knows what he's talking about. Now, he was very open about this whole enterprise being to the advantage of management.
And from episode 539.
If you want to know the motives of this project, you need only read the first public mission statement of Rockefeller's General Education Board that was printed in its first report to well-wishers, issued in 1906. In our dreams, people yield themselves with perfect docility to our molding hands. The present education conventions of intellectual and character education fade from their minds, and unhampered by tradition, we work our own will upon a grateful and responsive folk. Can you believe people actually wrote this and printed it? We shall not try to make these people or any of their children into philosophers or men of learning or men of science. We have not to raise up from them authors, educators, poets, men of letters. We shall not search for artists, painters, musicians, lawyers, doctors, preachers, politicians, statesmen, of which we have an ample supply. The task is simple. We will organize children and teach them in a perfect way the things their fathers and mothers are doing in an imperfect way. The real purpose of modern schooling was announced by Edward Ross of the University of Wisconsin in the same year that was written. Ross is generally considered one of the three founders of the 20th century discipline called sociology. And in a book bluntly called Social Control, Ross wrote, I'll quote directly, "Plans are underway to replace family, church, and community with propaganda, education, and mass media."
While their public education is increasingly structured as a marketing site to reproduce students as compliant servo mechanisms, all part of the coming GATT, too, or GATS. The rule of law is cumulatively overridden by transnational trade edicts to subjugate all that exists for corporate profit. Try to find a limit. There isn't one. Riot squads, club and gas, unarmed opponents, and civil liberties are stripped by Orwellian security machinations. Always the threat is against life and life means. That's the design of it, and I don't think it's preconscious. Always the threat is against life and life means to coerce compliance to corporate demands. Our country's national symbol for the hemisphere, health care for all, is degraded and privatized for profit as citizens are deprived of family positions by the hundreds of thousands. 30,000 in my own city of Guelph are without family physicians. Corporate motor commodities and schemes now so lay waste to Canada's land and water and public ways that it may be unsafe to breathe the air, walk freely, or count on a forest or aquatic habitat being there in a year. The vocation of serving fellow human and planetary life by one's daily service of work, our humanity itself, is slashed in every life function. Always the command is to turn money into more money for corporate investors or do not survive. Well, I think this is real terror. In fact, I would say it's the very threat to economic and financial security that the government legislation itself recognizes as terror is upon us. But as a structure, the U.S.-led structure here, you operate by projection. You project onto those who oppose you what you're doing yourself. It's a secret to their ideology and indeed their law of motion. The shape of this beast's ever grosser lines dwarfs the monster beheld by St. John of the Apocalypse or the boundless greed of Duryodhana of the tale told by the Mahabharata. We live, in fact, under an increasingly global reign of terror, but our disconnection from the meaning is its triumph.
Tell me at one time. Tell me out before I lose my mind.
Instead, we're made to believe that the terror comes from pre-industrial fanatics in poor countries.
Rebel leaders in hiding. You understand, in the caves, in the secret underground lair. Does that sound like anything familiar to you? Does that sound like the script from a James Bond movie? I think so too. Osama bin Laden in his secret underground lair. Sending the troops, they really don't care. But no one is supposed to die. No one is supposed to fry. That is the one big lie.
The world has been usurped by a pattern familiar in the microcosm but not yet decoded at the macro level, a revolt against human society itself. The historical maturation of nations after the world's greatest depression and war was called the Great Transformation by Karl Polanyi, but the Great Reversal has not yet been publicly deciphered. Its meaning is primeval. It is the atavistic return of society to an unaccountable male gang seeking to dominate the world.
486.
Sadism seemed to me to be the salient feature of the Bush-Cheney political culture that we experienced for the past 8 years. from the kinky torture to Cheney's so-called hunting, which is not hunting. Many of you live in rural areas where hunting is common, so you know what hunting is. Hunting is not what Cheney and his friends do. They do killing. They go to these so-called ranches where caged animals are released right in front of them so they can shoot at them. It's the shooting without the hunting. On one of these trips, Cheney shot 400 pheasants. 400 pheasants. They want to portray themselves as macho men, but they are cowards who shoot fish in a barrel, so to speak.
We see this pattern in the 9/11 war. Its public phase began with thousands of people of mixed nationalities, most American civilians, were killed by suicide bombers of a foreign male gang of Islamic fundamentalists. The numbers, by the way, interestingly changing from 6,900 to 3,900 to 2,772, just part of this whole operation and with very little publicity. Each side then duly proclaimed the other the embodiment of evil, same story. Each repudiated the law from start to finish, same story. And both killed as many innocent people as got in the way of their war to rule other countries, same story. While the gang leaders throughout stayed unscathed behind walls of armed protectors, both called each other cowardly murderers. There is little difference in moral substance between these atavistic gangs, although a megalomaniac rhetoric of each proclaims direct backing from God.
Born-again Christian George W. Bush himself said he was on a mission from God when he launched the invasions of Afghanistan and Iraq, invoking religion many times before enacting murderous policies. Not to mention Eric Prince, former Blackwater CEO of the mercenary force enlisted to carry out America's dirty work, who views himself as a Christian crusader, tasked with eliminating Muslims from the earth. Interestingly, I don't remember the outcry about Christian fanaticism causing the deaths of over 1 million Iraqis. Aside from its pure insanity, this type of crusader language only exacerbates the jihadists' belief that they're indeed fighting a holy war with the West, thus justifying their martyrdom. Overall, this attack is not about Islam. It's not about childlike concepts of good and evil. It's about a system that breeds inequality and oppression, the outcomes of which are exploited, the causes complex. It's not a fight between Islam and the West. It's a fight between the most extreme and militarized ideologues on all sides.
There is little difference in moral substance between these atavistic gangs, although a megalomaniac rhetoric of each proclaims direct backing from God. Both sides are mass killers, and both systematically destroy civilians and their means of life with sanctimonious justification, overriding all accountability to truth or due legal process. Both proclaim their mission as the work of divine justice, overriding all accountability to truth or due legal process.
266.
Professor David Ray Griffin.
For the first time, we are on the verge of a truly global empire, an empire with no borders. Our own country is involved in what Richard Falk and others call the Global Domination Project. And yet, from watching the mainstream media, you would never guess that these catastrophic events were going on. Like the Roman citizens during the Roman Empire, we are entertained and distracted with bread and circuses. I'm a Christian theologian, so what I am particularly upset about is their claiming to do this empire and this destruction of the world in the name of God. As a theologian, I deal with the relation between the divine and the demonic. And if you look at the Abrahamic traditions or you look at any of the major traditions in the world, there is a large agreement that that which we call holy, that which we call divine, is that which embodies truth, justice, compassion. So, if there is such a thing as the demonic, it would be that which is diametrically opposed to that and has power to threaten its very purposes. And so the demonic would be that which embodies the big lie, that which embodies injustice based on greed, and that which is, instead of having love and compassion, has total indifference to the welfare of those that they're inflicting their dominance on. The major media now have chosen to be the mouthpiece and the camouflage for this system that can only be called demonic.
Both proclaim their mission as the work of divine justice, and both destroy the lives and human conditions of innocent others with a pathological abandon that takes the breath away. That is, in fact, their function. It is of demonstration, destructions, and killings, to command by terror and seize whatever is wanted, with complicit governments like Canada's and Britain's barking and crouching behind.
413.
Professor Marnia Lazreg, author of Torture and the Twilight of Empire, from Algiers to Baghdad.
We have laws on the books that prohibit torture, but it's carried out anyway. And if you look at the U.S. intelligence operating manual, it really lists all of the methods that are prohibited. But we know that they're being used both in Guantanamo Bay and in Iraq. And of course, we're not talking about Afghanistan. Afghanistan also. I mean, the torturers were in Afghanistan found their way also in Abu Ghraib. At the end of an empire, torture appears as a very important method for keeping the power of the imperial nation in place. And the message that I'd like to convey is that torture was part and parcel of a military ideological structure. So it was not simply something incidental that happened on occasion because the French military grabbed someone whom they knew had some vital information. It was not that at all. It was used as the method of interrogation.
And here we must pause part one of The Terror Threat. Every voice you heard was broadcast on the radio program Unwelcome Guests between 2000 and 2019. You'll find them all at unwelcomeguests.net. And you'll find all of us at newworldnotes.blogspot.com. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, thanking you for listening to New World Notes. I'm also advising, illicit to my non-carborundum, reminding you that in solidarity there is strength, and hoping you'll tune in again for more of The Terror Threat next week. Till then...